As the bombs rain down on Baghdad, an American anti-globalization group is reporting that thousands of employees of Halliburton, U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney's former company, are working alongside U.S. troops in Kuwait and Turkey under a package deal worth close to $1 billion. According to U.S. Army sources, they are building tent cities and providing logistical support for the war in Iraq in addition to other hotspots in the war on terrorism. The military-industrial complex is a phrase we often hear as people struggle to comprehend the causes and consequences of war. Here on CKUT with us tonight is Pratap Chatterjee, an international journalist, to help us understand the concepts behind the military-industrial complex. Welcome, Pratap.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You've just written a report called Halliburton Makes a Killing on the Iraq War. Can you tell us a little bit about the situation with Halliburton and what Halliburton is?
Halliburton is a company based in Houston, Texas. It's a very large company that does what's called, their primary business is oil services, and they're the world's largest oil services company. And what this means is they go out and provide services to oil companies such as Exxon, Chevron, Mobil. They will build a pipeline. They will construct a deep sea platform, a whole bunch of services. They will help determine if there are oil deposits, drilling and testing for oil deposits that might be exploited in the future. So they're the biggest company in that business in the world and provide services in just about any country you can name. And that includes their existing subsidiaries now have previously worked in Iraq. And, they work everywhere in the world. Now, one of the things that Halliburton, this company, has done recently is acquire a company called Brown & Root. Brown & Root has been part of Halliburton for a few years now. Their history extends much further back to the Vietnam War and beyond. But they were contracted by the military as a construction company to build bases in Vietnam, where they were helping set up roads and runways and what have you. Now, just about 11, 12 years ago, Dick Cheney, the current Vice President of the United States, who was then Secretary of Defense, a career politician, I might add, having been a member of Congress and then being appointed to run the Pentagon, was approached or decided to find out if there was some way of minimizing or reducing costs within the military. And this is, you have to realize, in the early 1990s, is just after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the military was looking at downsizing in a major way, reducing the number of troops overseas, reducing the number of bases in this country. Where I live, which is in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area in California, we have dozens of bases, many of which have been closed down. So one way they realized they could reduce their costs is to be able to provide what I like to call MASH services, just the basic housing, cleaning, and feeding of troops by outside contractors, because they felt that, to have, a highly trained soldier come over from the United States to Uzbekistan or where have you to provide the services was expensive and not really necessary. So this contract Dick Cheney handed out to Halliburton, and it was sort of a small $3.9 million contract. They drew up a plan and submitted it back to the military. 6 months down the road, the military asked them to update this plan and make it, possible to actually execute it in practice, pay them another $1 million. And then lo and behold, guess who got the first contract? But Halliburton themselves, the first five-year contract. This contract is called the Logistics Civilian Augmentation Program, or LOGCAP for short. And over the years, Halliburton has gotten a lot of work from that. One primary example is a contract in Bosnia. And there, interestingly enough, after the first 5 years, the military decided to hand the overall contract to a rival of Halliburton, a company called DynCorp. However, since Halliburton was already running military bases under the previous contract in Bosnia, they ended up actually doing all the work and making most of the profits. They initially told the military it would cost $197 million for the first year, ended up costing $450 million. It became a very expensive project, $2.2 billion over the period of about 4 or 5 years. Now, Dick Cheney, at this point, your listeners may have realized, had left the administration since his former boss, Bush Senior, had lost elections to Bill Clinton. He went to work for a think tank for a couple of years and then was offered a job at Halliburton, and no simple job. He was offered the job of chief executive. And remember again that I mentioned that this man is a career politician. I'm sure he has some management skills, having run the Pentagon, but really he was kind of a bureaucrat with no experience in corporate America. Yet he gets the job of chief executive, and it's very simple. It's because of his Rolodex. He came to Halliburton with a trusted aide, Joe Gribben, who previously was in the Pentagon with him and became the head of government contracting, government relations rather, but effectively the man who lobbied the government to get contracts. And lo and behold, once again, the Halliburton contracts with the military increased, you know, something to the order of tenfold over this period of time that Dick Cheney was the CEO of Halliburton. When he left Halliburton, as when he was offered the job of a running mate of George Bush Jr., he cut a deal with the company. They gave him, allowed him to sell a bunch of shares, and they gave him a compensation package. Once you total these two, it adds up to something like $30 million. One of the things that he asked was to reduce his tax burden and therefore to defer this payment, part of this payment, over 5 years. So today, he is still being paid by Halliburton, which in my mind is most certainly a conflict of interest. The fact that this company is getting billions of dollars in contracts from the U.S. military and the State Department and the U.S. Navy and a whole bunch of other agencies, and vice president is still being paid by the company. Now, in the last 3 years, they have received a substantial boost. DynCorp got into trouble in Bosnia for their role in the smuggling of sex slaves, and therefore, I think that was one reason they lost the contract, the renewal of the contract, and it came to back to Halliburton. And in the last year, they have been getting a tremendous amount of work, starting in Uzbekistan, running out Camp Stronghold Freedom, which is one of the first bases from which the U.S. military launched the invasion of Afghanistan. They now have operations in 7 countries, Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, Kuwait, Jordan, Turkey, Djibouti, and Georgia. 7 countries, a total of $830 million in contracts in the last year alone. That doesn't count the contracts they have with the U.S. Navy, for example, to build something called CONCAP, which included building the prisons for the Taliban in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. It doesn't include the contracts of the State Department to repair embassies, for example, in Uzbekistan or Albania, a total of something like 70 countries. It doesn't include their contracts in this country, for example, to run the El Centro naval facility down in Southern California or to help run Fort Knox in Kentucky. It doesn't include the cleanup and decontamination and of military bases like the Fort Ord base down in Monterey here in California. So they're making a tremendous amount of money, this oil services company, out of the current administration and us as taxpayers in the United States.
In 1961, a former five-star general and President Dwight D. Eisenhower warned of the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power. Do you think that this, when he coined the term military-industrial complex, do you think what you've just described, the intersection of political power and corporate power, is an example of this? And how does it affect foreign policy in the U.S.?
I guess you could say that. It's funny because I'm sort of a little wary of that term, military-industrial complex. I see that kind of as a little bit of a conspiracy theory and a sort of a political theory that belongs sort of in either academia or some such thing, as opposed to I'm just talking facts. I'm just talking reality. I'm just a journalist. I'm stating the fact that this company has made $1 billion, and this guy used to be the CEO, and now he's vice president. Very simply stated, there's a conflict of interest at the very least. I would go so far as to say it's corruption, and people should be prosecuted for this kind of thing. And I wouldn't be surprised if down the road we got evidence that they had been working hand in hand, that there was, you know, a political dimension to, or simply a corruption dimension to the way these contracts have been handed out. And I've always been skeptical, depending on the circumstances. For example, I've done a little bit of writing from Afghanistan about the possibility of a pipeline being put through there, and a lot of people believe that that's the reason we went to war there. I actually don't agree, and I think a pipeline is not going to happen in the near-term future. However, in, you know, talking to people in the petroleum industry, they have pointed out that the people close, you know, high up in the administration and people high up in the petroleum industry are, in fact, very close friends. And so I don't know if there's a conspiracy or anything deliberate about it. I think it's just their natural nepotistic world that's playing out. In the case of this administration, I don't know. I hate to use that term, but I can't see that it's inaccurate. I mean, it's simply true that they are one and the same. Here, there is, you know, people in power hire their friends, and their friends happen to be people who also work in industry.
You mentioned that cheap labor is one of the primary reasons for outsourcing services. So this means that people in the countries themselves are providing the labor power. These are countries with often strong domestic opposition to U.S. foreign policy. What is it like? Do you have a sense of what it's like for those workers to be supporting the U.S. war effort?
I can speak of a couple of different examples here where Brown & Root is concerned. One is Turkey, where I just returned from Turkey, and something like 94% of the population is opposed to the war in Iraq. Not quite maybe as violently as, let's say, people in Yemen, where there have been, you know, street battles with the police, or even, you know, here in San Francisco, where people have locked down and shut down streets. But I don't know that there's two things here. The people are getting paid a lot less than a U.S. soldier would get. However, in the context of their local country, they're actually getting paid relatively well. So one of the places I visited was a place called Incirlik. It's a military base just outside the city of Adana, about an hour from the Mediterranean coast. And I met with the union. I met with former employees of Brown & Root. And they pointed out that people will pay and do pay people, you know, who control this as much as $5,000 to get a job on the base, because ultimately it pays twice as much as regular jobs do. There's not a lot of jobs. Remember, this is an area that's quite depressed. It's not too far from the Iraqi border. It's depressed because all the jobs that existed 10 years ago have collapsed as a result of the sanctions on oil trading over there. So there are people looking for jobs, and they're happy to get a job. And so they will even pay for that. And, of course, there's other perks, which is, you know, access to the base exchange, the PX, which, especially in the past, was, you know, an easy way to buy perfume and things like that. And in the town of Adana, there's a place called American Bazaar, or American Market or Bazaar, where they resell things that they have bought out of the base exchange. So people take these jobs. However, at the same time, there's this interesting sort of conflict where the unions have actually gone on strike or protests five times in the last 10 years, because the problem, even though they paid more, is that inflation is so high, and they paid in Turkish lira, that they want the workers, who are, in this case, in Turkey, are strongly unionized. There's a war workers union called Habish. Is they're worried that their pay may drop. And it's always a complicated negotiation. But at the end of the day, they end up making more than the average worker there. So they go on strike because unions have the power to be able to force wages up. And they do that. And they survive much better than other people. So people are opposed to war, but they would like, it's not as black and white as one would think. It's the fact is that people need and want these jobs. In Somalia, for example, Brown and Root employees rioted when they were laid off during the American intervention there, and UN troops, peacekeepers, had to be brought in to quell this riot. In not all circumstances are the workers from the country itself. So, for example, as you might imagine, in building the facilities for the Taliban prisoners in Cuba, they weren't actually able to bring in Cuban workers because that would just have been a no-no. So they imported workers from the Philippines in that case. So they brought them in, they paid them a relatively decent wage for their circumstances in the Philippines, but still, you know, a tenth of what they would have, a U.S. soldier or worker would have been paid, or less than that, in fact. But they cut a deal with the government of Gloria Macapagal Arroyo to bypass any special visa requirements, and they, you know, shipped them out by the plane load, until there was a little bit of a scandal in the Philippines over that. So it's a complex equation, but they're getting paid less. But in their circumstances, it's often better than no job at all.
You've just returned from Turkey and Kurdistan. One of the justifications of the U.S. hostility towards the Iraqi regime has been its treatment of its Kurd population. Can you speak a little bit about what the feeling is or what your sense of the situation is with the Kurds in Turkey and in northern Iraq?
Yeah. I didn't make it to northern Iraq, but you know, the idea that the American U.S. government is going in there on behalf of the Kurds is just, you know, either naivete on the part of people who believe that, and just a bold-faced lie in terms of the U.S. administration. They're going in there. Actually, right now, it's ironic. There was an article in today's papers that the soldiers in Iraq have started naming their bases after oil companies, which I think, you know, shows the soldiers aren't as dumb as you think. I mean, this is a war about oil. There's forward operating base Shell and forward operating base Exxon. These are the names that soldiers have given the bases in Iraq that they're fighting from. And that's exactly why they're there. They're not there to help the Kurds. And if they were really interested in helping the Kurds, maybe the United States, in contrast to the European Union, would care about the plight of the Kurds across the border in Turkey, you know, which is a democracy of sorts, not quite the same as a democracy like India or the United States or some such thing. But this is a country where if you're talking about 5,000 people being massacred in Halabja in northern Iraq, what about the 30,000 people that have been massacred in the last 20 years in Turkey as a result of the conflict in southeastern Turkey? And just to give a background to your listeners who might not know who the Kurds are, they're said to be the largest minority community in the world without a country, and they straddle their land straddle five countries: southeastern Turkey, northern Iraq, Armenia, former Soviet Union, Iran, and Syria. And these people are treated extremely badly in whatever country. It's true in northern Iraq that they have been treated very badly by Saddam Hussein, and have actually, in fact, they're pretty happy with the U.S. military in the sense that they, as a result of the no-fly zones, have been able to create their own government, you know, which and they've had much better jobs and have been living lives much better than most of the other Kurds, and certainly have in the past. However, at the same time, they realize there's this tenuous relationship. The moment this no-fly zone ceases to exist, either because the Americans leave or because Saddam Hussein's regime is defeated, they're going to face, once again, discrimination and problems from whoever takes power in Baghdad, and also from across the border in Turkey, where the government there has never been kind to them ever since the creation of Turkey 80 years ago by Ataturk, and most certainly not in the last 20 years. So people there are not, the Kurds are uniform in opposing the war. In northern Iraq, there is certainly a divided opinions, because people also feel that they would like to, for very compelling reasons, get rid of Saddam Hussein's regime. I think what people are realizing, especially in central and southern Iraq now, is that the American intervention is coming with its costs, and people who have traditionally completely opposed Saddam Hussein, the Shiites, are realizing how expensive and how difficult and how much, how little the Americans care about civilian life. And so I suspect that if there is a conflict there, and there very well might be and most likely will be, there's going to be a lot of division among the Kurdish communities as to whether or not they support the Americans. Remember, this is a community that doesn't like the being ruled by outside forces, which is why there's been such a difficult struggle for autonomy that's been very violent in the last 20 years. The same thing is going to play itself out at the moment the walls around northern Iraq, the no-fly zones, collapse. We're going to see tremendous conflict.
Some people have said that that the American war effort is an effort at recolonization. If the military-industrial complex is an inappropriate lens to look at this through, what's your opinion of the lens of neocolonialism?
These are just obviously just my opinion. So, whereas the military-industrial complex is something that I think is, it's a theoretical and academic term. I think I did mention that I do think it exists certainly under this administration. And I do think this is about oil wealth. I mean, I think there's two aspects to it. One is it's about oil wealth. It is about recolonization and globalization and what have you. But I also think it's about the domestic election and political fortune of the Bush administration here back at home. And they're in it as much as for the oil as for the fact that they realize that they have completely failed in this country to resolve economic issues, and that without some kind of distraction, some form of weapon of mass distraction, they are going to so lose, you know, the battle for hearts and minds in this country. And so what it needs is some distraction. And what could be better than the current news media's infatuation with, you know, what can only be described as a military trade show on television?
We've been speaking with Pratap Chatterjee, an independent journalist. His latest article, Halliburton Makes a Killing on Iraq War, is on the web at www.corpwatch.org. He is also the producer of a documentary about the Kurds. Can you give us the website for that, Pratap?
Yeah, if you go to www.radioproject.org, and you can probably do a search on it. The show aired a week ago, the 21st, I think, of March. So if you go through the archives, it may not be on the front page. There may be a link. I'm not sure. You should be able to find it, and you can download it as an MP3 and listen to it on your or as a real file and listen to it on your computer.
Pratap Chatterjee, independent journalist from the San Francisco Bay Area on CKUT 90.3 FM here in Montreal. My name is Dexter X. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.